Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Each episode is a conversation with inspiring people who make wonderful contributions to our knowledge in these areas and spark curiosity and ideas to pursue. Join me, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
Stop being like everybody else and start being like you. The dumb thing is, we were all born unique, and then we spend the next 30 years of our lives trying to fit in. And it's ridiculous. No one that stood out in life did it by following anyone else. Focus on those that resonate with you. Get clients that you can connect with effortlessly. Because the more effort you put into making a relationship, the less effort you can focus on actually perpetuating it, what it is that you're supposed to be doing for the person. So I'm a great believer that stop trying to be like anyone else.
Hi there, innovator. It's really great to be back with another episode. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. I trust, too, that you enjoyed my recent conversations with Vivian Goh of Simple Wealth Coaching and with Andrew van der Beek of Illuminate. Do you know anyone that's worked with Sir Elton John or with Elon Musk? Someone who's sent people down to see the wreck of the Titanic on the seabed? Or closed museums in Florence for a private dinner party and then had Andrea Bocelli serenade them while they ate their pizza? Well, now you do. Today we're going to meet Steve Sims. Quoted as the real-life Wizard of Oz by Forbes and Entrepreneur magazine, Steve Sims is a best-selling author with Blue Fishing, The Art of Making Things Happen. He's a sought-after consultant and a speaker at a variety of networks, groups, and associations, as well as having spoken at the Pentagon and at Harvard. As the founder of Bluefish, one of the top personal concierge services, and an expert marketer within the luxury industry, Steve has been quoted in a lot of publications and also in TV, among them The Wall Street Journal, Forbes, London Sunday Times, South China Morning Post, and many more. Stay tuned for a fascinating glimpse into the life of an entrepreneur whose day job is to spend other people's money to make the impossible possible, and whose no is not an answer approach has and is taking him on an amazing journey. A quick promotional message from our sponsor, InnovaBiz. We help coaches and consultants build professional credibility, engage their target audience, and connect with their ideal clients. Now, to get absolute clarity about who your ideal clients are and how you help them, take a look at our Marketing Master mini class. In less than 30 minutes, you'll gain absolute clarity on your ideal client and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. Access the Marketing Master mini class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free and accessible without even giving away your email. In our discussion today, Steve talked to me about how to ask good questions, and he explained that if you get a no, you're either asking the wrong question or the wrong person. He described why most people are petrified of the word why or the question why. And he described how he discovers people's true motivations beyond their expressed needs and then delivers an outrageously remarkable experience for them. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Steve Sims. Hi, Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Los Angeles in the USA, in his bike shed, as he was just showing me, Steve Sims, who's an expert in the art of communication and building relationships. He's the author of the book Blue Fishing, and he's the host of the Art of Making Things Happen podcast. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Steve. It's a great privilege to have you as my guest.
Thanks for having me.
Now, George Bryan, who was our guest on episode 226 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, suggested that we have a conversation with you, Steve. So a big shout out to George.
Cheers, George.
Yeah. Steve, you've been described as the real-life Wizard of Oz, and essentially you make dreams come true by creating experiences for your clients that they could never have imagined possible themselves. You've been quoted in various publications, in TV, and in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, London Sunday Times, South China Morning Post, to name just a few. I'm really looking forward to exploring how you got to where you are today and also talk about the art of communicating and building relationships. But before we get on to that, I know you've come from a background of starting your working life as a bricklayer and then landing in Hong Kong in a financial advisor that you lasted a whole 24 hours in. And from there, you've built up your blue fishing business by understanding people's desires, I think, and finding ways to help them make those desires happen. Now, of course, there's a journey leading up to that today, which you outline in the book Blue Fishing, and I'd encourage everyone to read that. What I'm really curious about is what are some of the core beliefs that fueled that journey that kept you going, particularly when there were times, and I'm sure there were lots of them, where people said, no, you can't do that.
I don't think I had drive. You see, I'm a great believer that people either run to something or run away from something. And both of those are fine as long as they're handled. You know, if you're running away from a bad relationship, then, you know, that's never going to happen. You've always got to confront it. But I was running away from stuff I didn't like to do, looking for something I did want to do. But I didn't know what that was. So as an entrepreneur, I would try so many jobs, cake sales, insurance, door-to-door. I would try so many different things trying to find out where I fit. So I'm not quite sure I had a lot of drive and focus as much as I had a lot of aggravation that I hadn't found my thing yet. You know, when am I going to find what I'm good at? When am I going to find my, as I say now, your true passion, your true north? I couldn't find it. So as a young lad, being big and ugly and being aggravated, people thought I was just going to get in trouble all the time because I didn't like to settle, never liked to settle. I'd never settle now. So I think a lot of people just thought, well, that guy, he's just off the rails. You know, he's got ADD, you know, he's got shiny object disorder, you know, all the usual kind of traits that us as entrepreneurs had, I had and I have. But I think what it was I just couldn't believe that this was it. So every time I would be in a room, every time I would be doing a job, every time I was working on a project, I'd be like, is this it? Is this challenging me? Am I excited? And of course, if I wasn't, I was the kind of idiot that would just stand up and go, nah, not doing this. And I would just walk out of a meeting or walk out of a job. And so, you know, it was a very challenging upbringing, shall we say.
Yeah. But clearly you were very quick to make decisions then when you decided, no, this isn't what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
So I'll try something else.
Yeah, I think, yes, I was very quick to react. And again, as a hothead, that didn't work. So a lot of the times it got me in trouble. A lot of the times in the early stages of my life when I would quote people prices, I would do it quickly and end up finding out that I'd undercharge them. So there was a lot of times that my speed of response got me in trouble or got me on my back foot. But I was very quickly also to change track. So I wanted this to work. And if it's not working like this, well, I'm going down here. I'm going to make it. I'm going to find an angle. How's this going? And I would rabbit hole my way into finding out the best route for it to work, even though 9 times out of 10, it wasn't direct.
So when did you realize you had a knack or a passion for creating experiences for people and connecting people together with others that could make those experiences happen for them?
I didn't and I don't. And here's the funny thing. I grew up as an uneducated bricklayer from East London. So I didn't have any knowledge of any luxury. I didn't have any knowledge of rejection because I'd never tried anything. My family were working class folks that we just did what we did. So therefore, I never had any fear of anything because I'd never been confronted with it before. So when someone said, oh, I want to do this, my goal was to look after you because I wanted to talk to you because you had a nice suit on, you had nice cars, you were going to offer me a job or give me a lot of money. Whatever the task was that you were asking me to do held no fear for me whatsoever because I'd never been challenged with it before. I would walk up to someone and I'd go, hey, I got four guys coming to this party tonight. Do you want them here at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock? I wouldn't ask if I could bring them. I wouldn't ask permission that they could get in. I would say, hey, I got four guys coming here tonight. Purely assumptive. What do you want? 8 or 9 o'clock? What would be best for them to turn up for you? And they'd be like, oh, 8 o'clock. Great. You know, so I just had a way of making sure I never asked a question which stood me in a liability. So if I went up to you and I asked you, hey, can you do this for me? You know, you can say yes or no. And if you don't know me and you're confronted by that directness, your knee-jerk reaction is going to go no. But if I say to you, hey, I really want this to happen, what are we going to do to make that happen next Tuesday? You can't go no, because you sound like an idiot. Because it's not a conversation. There was no. You can go no to what? I didn't ask you yes or no. I asked you what needs to happen. You end up sounding like a moron. So I learned that trick very, very early on. That never ask a question which I can't suffer. That I can suffer with a liability. So that was the early stages, and I found that I had a knack of not caring what the response was. And I wasn't always as good as it as I am now. You know, you get better over time. But I quickly learned that if I got a no, I asked the wrong person or the wrong question. Hmm. And so if someone said no to me, I'd be like, oh, damn, there's got to be another gatekeeper because there's always two doors to a house. That was my mentality. There's always two ways to get into the living room.
I love that.
And you've just said no to me. Oh, now I've got to find the other way, you know? Hmm. But maybe I asked you something the wrong way. So I'd learn from that, and then I'd go. There were many times in the early stages of my career that I had people, you know, hanging out with Ferrari or Hollywood or, you know, the jet set, and there would have been one gatekeeper that turned around and had said no to me, and I'd gone through the other door, and now I'm stood there, and they'd be like, I thought I told you no. You did, but he didn't. You know, so it was that kind of thing very early on. So I had a lack of fear of rejection. I didn't care about getting a no because it didn't make my nose bleed. It didn't hurt me. It didn't cost me anything. And to me, avoid getting rejected or getting a no, then don't ask a question that someone can say no to. So I think my early skill set was just in not being frightened to ask. And let's be blunt, a lot of people today quite simply are just terrified to ask.
That's right. Well, the fear of rejection is so big, isn't it? So
huge.
And you've just outlined a brilliant way to get, well, first of all, I guess don't take rejection personally because it's not about you.
No.
But the second thing is, you know, how can you ask a question so that it's not a yes or no situation?
I was actually chatting with Chris Voss. Chris Voss is an FBI negotiator, and I had him on my podcast, and I was with him at Joe Polish's Genius Network annual event a couple of weeks ago. And he was talking to me about affirmation and comfort. And he said that people have they have a yes limitation. If I say to you, hey, how's the weather over there? Is it good? And you go, yeah. I say, oh, have you had a good day? Yeah. So how are you feeling today? You good? Yeah. If you keep answering yes to three questions, you start getting suspicious as to why I'm asking you these questions that you can only say yes to. So you get concerned and you actually get what he calls yes fatigue. You actually don't want to say yes anymore because yes is a confirmation. And you don't want to commit. You don't want to confirm something. And you start getting suspicious that I've got you to confirm, commit, confirm, commit, confirm. You get suspicious. But I mean, think about it in your head. If someone asks you a question that you had to answer yes to, and they asked you four questions, you're going to start, where is this going? You know, you do that. But you know, the funny thing is that doesn't exist with the word no, because the no is a final word. The no is your comfort word. I say to you, hey, can I borrow 10 bucks? No. You feel comfortable, okay? But if I said to you, hey, would it be ridiculous if you gave me 10 bucks? You could say no and feel comfortable, but it actually becomes a confirmation.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that make sense? So he was telling us the different words. He was teaching us the different ways you can actually use no as a confirmation and affirmation, because people get yes fatigue. So if you can say, hey, is it true you're going to give up on us working together next week? Are you telling me you don't want to do this? You know, if you rephrase it, is it ridiculous that you're going to be paying me before Wednesday? You know, any of those no's become a confirmation, and people are far more comfortable to say no a lot of times than they are yes. It was a very interesting twist.
Phrasing the question such that you either can't get a no, or using no in a creative way, that's a really fascinating approach. And I think, you know, we talked a little bit about fear, and you talk a lot about fear in the book, which is fascinating, because you've just told us that you really don't have fear because you hadn't experienced a lot of these things before.
Yeah, correct.
So talk to us a little bit more about fear, because you talk a lot in the book about our biggest fear and how, you know, you've had some approaches to overcome that.
Nine times out of 10, and here's the dumb thing. We already know these answers. We know full well that it's never as painful as you think it's going to be. It's never as devastating as you dream it's going to be. Because our fear amplifies and accelerates on such a vast interest rate that it could never be as bad as what we think of it. And the more that I got involved in things, and the more that I turned around to a group of people staring at me going, how did you do that? And my response was, well, forget how did I do it. Why did you not try? And I found that the fear and the anxiety, and it happened a couple of times, and I can't recall when it was, but I know it did, when I would say to myself, well, everyone seems scared to ask that guy, so I won't. And guess what? That was the only time I didn't get it. That was the only time it didn't happen. And I'd be thinking to myself, I listen to other people. I based my ability on other people's fears. And I noticed then that the most successful people, and it's very lucky because I have a lot of people in my consulting and concierge business that quite simply are the richest people in the world, but they all share one thing in common. They are serial failures. They try businesses, they go bust, they try another one, it goes pop, they try this. All that worked quite well until it doesn't. And there's no one that's successful. Elon Musk, Bill Gates, Richard Branson, Steve Jobs, they've all had immense, unfathomable failures and cock-ups in their life. And they have never allowed it to define them. They've allowed it to refine them. So I've led by them. I'm led by the way they look at things and go, okay, that went wrong. What did I learn from it? Now, I never went to college. I never went to university. But I have an MBA, PhD, and several degrees in cocking up. And they taught me some of the best lessons out there. And as I said to you before, I've gone, oh, yeah, I can do that. That'd be 20 grand. And the person's wired me 20 grand or written a check for 20 grand. And then I've got back to find out that I didn't equate for this, and it's actually 22 grand. And not only am I not making any money, I'm actually paying 2 grand towards the client's experience. And that taught me how to write invoices, how to gauge a reaction, how to go, well, okay, let me go back. Let me work out what that's going to be. And that taught me how to do it. That 2 grand taught me how to focus on my negotiation and my invoices and the quoting.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a couple of really good points there. First of all, you know, very successful people aren't afraid to fail. And the, one of the keys, I think, there is that they try out different things. And then the failure actually provides a lot of lessons. So if you're open to those lessons and then incorporating those into the next experiment you do, that generally leads to a much better outcome.
Oh, 100%. I've noticed so many people that fail, that choose that to be their defining moment. Now, I don't know about you, but me falling on my backside should never be my defining moment. Me standing up, me conquering the odds, me working it out, that should be the defining moment. But I am stunned how many people choose the falling over to be the defining.
Mm-hmm.
It makes no sense.
It doesn't, yeah. But I guess it's, like I said earlier, the rejection, we tend to take rejection personally. So if somebody says, well, no, I don't, I'm not going to do that, it's kind of, that's a rejection of me personally as opposed to a rejection of the idea or the proposal.
Well, again, you're down to those them and us people. Those people that do actually are that frightened, are that scared, are not the ones that are going to conquer the top of the hill. You know, I remember speaking with Elon Musk down at SpaceX, and I had a friend of mine, sorry, he wasn't a friend, he was a client of mine, and he was trying to engage Elon in a conversation, and he came out with the stupidest question. He started bringing up the fact that NASA was laughing at him because of his space project as though it was a hobby. And obviously, Elon had had this a million times before because Elon didn't even make eye contact with the client. He just literally just turned around and said, they always laugh at you before they applaud. And I thought to myself, Danny's brilliant. Now, I'd imagine he'd had that one-liner in his wheelhouse forever. But the bottom line of it is, how valuable is it that all of the greats out there have been the laughing stock before they've been revered as genius.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a great approach to take and say, well, you always fail before the biggest success. And, you know, there's the old saying that it's always darkest before the dawn. But to have that as a mindset and then actually celebrate, if people are laughing at you, celebrate because, you know, you won't be laughing tomorrow. Kind of attitude is much better than taking that personal rejection and then sulking or not taking action to move forward.
Yeah, totally. I remember, and I don't know if this is the right time to bring it up, but I remember my dad, who was, you know, a big, thick Irish lad. I was about 14 years old and we were walking down the street. He was smoking his, I don't know, 400th cigarette that morning. And, he just put his hand on my shoulder as we were walking, didn't make eye contact, pulled a cigarette out of his mouth. And I remember him saying this word for word. He said, son, no one ever drowned by falling in the water. They drowned by staying there. He puts his cigarette back in his mouth and carries on walking. As a young lad, I stopped and I was like, what the hell was that? And I had no idea what it was. But, you know, that's always stayed with me. I don't know where it came from, but I've always remembered that saying for that fact.
Yeah. Yeah, it is very profound, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. Great wisdom with your dad.
Yeah.
All right. Now, one of the things that is fascinating, and you tell a couple of stories in the book that highlight this, and that's when people ask you for help, so I've got this experience that I'd love to have. It's on my bucket list. Can you help make that happen? You go through a process to really get to know what motivates them to have that request and understand what's behind that request, because then you go on to make something happen that's actually well beyond what they thought might be possible. So explain to us how you do that.
I'm a great believer that people are embarrassed about telling you what they really want. And so I do it by asking why. And someone will say to me, hey, I want to meet Elton John. You know, I want to play piano with him. And I say, oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, that's brilliant. Why is that important? And then the second response may be, again, some kind of, well, you know, he's an icon and he's great. And I agree with you. But why is it important to you? And you've got to get down to the core. You've got to get down to the reason behind it. Once you know where you're starting from, you can work out where you need to end up to surpass what they're hoping for. But you will get these people that will say something and it either sounds good or they would kind of like it, where you can literally divert them and send them down a completely different direction for either cheaper with a greater experience. So the job, and this is everyone's business, not just mine. I don't care if you're a mortgage broker, a real estate vendor, a baker. It doesn't matter. Give the client what they want and desire and not what they ask for.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a great message there. You know, understand really what they desire, not what they ask for necessarily, and look for the motivations. And I think you told a great story about two people who had asked for that. And the one that you made happen was the one where there was a really deep emotional why connection.
Oh, you want about the Elton John one?
Yeah.
So we had, and it was funny that it happened in 1 week. If I couldn't have had a better example than this 1 week. So we've been working for Elton John for about 8 years, and we had this guy contact us, and he went, "Hey, I wanna meet Elton John. You know, I really wanna meet him. You know, and I know you're working for him. I want to meet him at an Oscar party. You know, how much is that going to be?" So I said, "Oh, let me just find out how much that's going to be, and I'll just do that. But while I got you on the phone, why is it important to you?" And his response was, "Oh, because he's an icon, and there's not a lot of living legends around anymore, and he's probably going to die soon, and I want a picture before he does."
Hmm.
And I thought, "Oh, that's a bit." So I was like, "Oh, okay. Hey, let me get that price, and I'll come back to you. I'll give you a shout." Okay, never contacting him again. And then another guy contacted me a couple of days later. And at first, I thought it was the same guy, okay? And the guy was like, "Hey, how you doing? Yeah, I'd really like to meet Elton John. I really want to get a photograph with him, and I really want to talk to him. And I know you work for Elton John." I was like, "Oh, yeah, you know, we do, and that's great. Yeah, you get a photo, brilliant. But why is it important to you?" And he went down the exact same answer again as the other guy. He was like, "Well, he's a titan and he's a legend, and you know, sadly, you know, he's getting on in life, and I really, really want to meet the guy, and you know, his music's fantastic, and well, you know." And it was that last hesitation, and if he hadn't have done that, I'd have hung up. It was that last hesitation that made me go, "There's something else here." I went, "Tell me more. Why is Elton John so important to you?" And he went quiet. And then he turned around and he said, "When I was a kid," his voice changed, his tone changed, everything changed. He said, "When I was a kid, my dad used to take me to school and pick me up. It was our thing. My dad used to take me to school and pick me up. Not my mum, my dad. And we had one cassette in the car that was Elton John." He said, "And all the way to school and all the way back from school, from a kid through my teens, even when I didn't want to do it, we would sing Elton John there and back from school every single day."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Do you know what? When I'm driving down the road and Elton John comes on the radio, my dad's with me in the car." And that was it. That was the beauty. And he wanted to tell Elton John about how his music brought his dad back to him every single second he sang. And so we arranged it because there was the core. There was the you could work with that. You know, some idiot wanting a bloody selfie, no substance. This guy had a root, a trigger, a cause. There was every need to make this happen.
Yeah, that's a great story. I love that. And it's so powerful when there's the connection to that emotion when you can actually tap into that by asking those why questions.
Yeah, they're the most, you know, people will contact me via text and they go, hey, Steve, I got your text. I got your phone number from so-and-so. We should talk. And I will respond with one word, why?
Yeah.
And people will find it very offensive. And they'll be like, well, I thought you were cool. This is so rude. And I won't respond. But they get so upset when I've just asked the simple reason why. And the reason behind it is very simple. I want to know what you're hoping is going to come out of a conversation between us. I don't know you. You've got my phone number. You've reached out to me in probably quite a cold fashion. And so quite simply, I want to know why. Why do you want to have this call? Why is it important to you? And people still find the why reason. You know, someone can say to you, hey, do you want to have dinner with me tonight? And if you say why, they will go, God, that's a bit, they will be taken back. Why is a word that for some reason puts people on their back foot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, try it. If someone says to you, hey, do you want to grab coffee? You know, just look at them and go, why? just watch the response. It's weird, but why still scares the bejeebus out of a lot of people?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we use why a lot in our marketing process and analyzing the we like to do the five whys exercise when we analyze, you know, the ideal client or what their needs are in particular. So when somebody says, well, our client wants this, or their biggest frustration is X, and so we can deliver Y that addresses that. And I always ask why and dig deeper, because often, or nearly always actually, there's something behind that frustration of X or need of X that goes deeper. And if you can tap into that, just like your story with the emotion, if you can tap into that and you can then deliver something that's well beyond what they're expecting, and also well beyond what others might be doing if they're not going through that sort of process.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, it's fascinating. I'm curious what experience has given you the most satisfaction that you've enabled other people to have, because you're there for each one of them, aren't you? You kind of stage manage the whole experiences, and you're there as well. So what you get to experience them yourself. What is one or more that you've gotten the most satisfaction and joy out of?
Well, the good thing is I'm a selfish bugger. So I only go on the ones that kind of give me that impact. So if it's tedious, boring, dull, done it before, yeah, I pass it to one of my other team. But if there's ones that can like go, oh, I like that, I get involved. So therefore, only the good ones I've been on. You know, I've closed down museums and had a dinner party for six at the feet of Michelangelo's David in Florence, and had Andrea Bocelli come in and serenade him halfway through the pasta. I had a client that wanted to meet the rock band Journey. That sounded boring. So we actually arranged for him to walk on stage, join a concert in San Diego, sing four tunes with them, and is now deemed as the shortest-term lead singer of the rock band Journey. I've sent people down to the Titanic. I've had them do drum lessons with Guns N' Roses, guitar lessons with ZZ Top, sit front row at the a fashion show, walk on the runway of a fashion show. If the why is there, then it excites me. Now, here's the dumb thing. I don't have to care about fashion. I don't have to care about Italian music or museums. I care about the reason why, and that's the thing that excites me. If I can conclude that chapter, that emotion, cement that trigger, then that's what does it for me.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I get that. Here's the dumb thing. I don't know if it's dumb, but I get that exact same thrill now, and it sounds conceited, with when I'm consulting clients. You see, I run the world's largest and most successful experiential concierge firm for 23 years plus. And I was spending rich people's money giving them awesome experiences. Since the book came out, I'm now dealing with entrepreneurs under Sims Distillery or under our Speakeasy consulting program teaching them how to get out of the way of themselves, identify the root, identify the core, identify the reason. A lot of companies don't have a reason. And I'm able to kind of like inject as much as I can into it by, first of all, getting them uncomfortable and removing them as the problem, which is 99% of the issue, and then seeing them grow. Because when you can, when you close down a museum, the only person that gets to experience it are the six people inside that have spent a lot of money to make it happen. When you can consult with an entrepreneur and make his business more dynamic, more profitable, and as Joe Polish says, make it an elf business, easy, lucrative, and fun, it doesn't just help the entrepreneur. It helps everyone in his gravitational pull, his staff, his team, his family, his wife, his parents, his kids. Everyone around them benefits from that one person doing better. Hmm. And that's where my excitement is now. That's what arouses me.
Okay. And so what are some of the principles from your experience with creating these experiences that you've taken into that consulting program?
Well, for one, a lot of people aren't focused on where they're going. Okay. They want something to happen, but it's very woolly as to what it is. When I go and do an experience, my first thing I ever do is I go for a Hail Mary. What is the most ridiculous, over-the-top option for this to be done for my client? You know, my client wanted a quality meal in Florence. I closed down the museum for him. I could have got him a restaurant booking on the Italian version of Open Table, and it would have given him what he wanted. But it wasn't enough for me. So I went and thought, how big can I make it? Now, if I had failed to get the museum, and I'll be honest with you, I'm stunned I got it. But if I'd have failed to get the museum, I would have come down and maybe ended up with a beautiful apartment overlooking the Palazzo Vecchio or something. You know, I would have failed, but easily surpassed what he had asked me to do. Now, the good thing about going like that is they don't know all of my failures. They just know that what they got was 30 times more of an experience than what they had first asked me. So you can risk all in a low liability stake. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
And when people market, when people do that copy, when people brand themselves, when people start working on that social feed, they dilute. They go, well, he's been saying this, so I've got to say it like this. They've been showing pictures like that, or that's what I've got to do. I've got to he dresses like that. That's how I've got to dress. And the first thing you do is get them uncomfortable by going, hang on a minute, this is what would be acceptable. Let's surpass acceptable into the lustful. Let's see, where can we go that is just so beyond where acceptable is that you can afford to fail and still be 50% above what the competitors are doing? And that's what I try to do. I try to find out, what is the client asking for? What is acceptable to the client? And what surpasses that into the lustful? What makes you a desired commodity? Yeah, you may think, well, I do tax returns. Oh, I bake cakes. Oh, I fix your car. Okay. What about if you're fixing someone's car and instead of having a bad coffee machine, you have a barista in there serving up cappuccinos while they wait? You know, just something like that. Fresh magazines, nice sofas, so that it's a comfortable experience. And quite simply, we are all in the experience business now. Amazon is not. And you've got to do everything Amazon does and everything it doesn't do. And what it doesn't do is create an experience. In fact, it is the opposite of experience. It gives you no feeling whatsoever. You order toilet roll, you want it on Tuesday, you get it on Tuesday. That's it. But if you go to a store and you go, hey, I want toilet roll, and they go, hey, here's some toilet. By the way, we've actually got a special on this. Oh, we've also got these toilet roll covers. And when was the last time you actually checked your toilet roll holder? You know, is it sturdy? Is it coming off the wall? Because we got the, it's that. And I'm focusing now on toilet rolls. You can create an experience around anything. And I will give you a story on that. I had a baker that contacted me, and I was working with him as one of my speakeasy members. And he wanted to turn his bakery into the best bakery. And I said, well, you're not going to turn it into the best bakery by making the best cakes. Because quite simply, they're only going to know it's the best cakes if they eat them, you know? And so the first thing you've got to do is get people coming into your bakery. So I told him to start focusing on the why, the core, and the reason. And he had this guy come in, and he wanted this cake done, and he wanted the cake done in red. And he said, okay, why is it? You know, my dad's birthday. And I said, he said, okay, fine. And he remembered all of this, and he went further. And he said, well, okay, why red? He said, well, my dad likes Ferrari. So, you know, a red cake, you know, with some candles on it, you know, it's a Ferrari red. And he said, okay, what is his birth year? So he got his birth year out of him. And he said, why don't we order some little die-cast cars, little Ferrari die-cast cars of that period, and actually have them around the cake. And on the top of the cake, we have the Cavallino horse. And the guy was blown away that a simple cake went from just being a red cake to actually being a Ferrari cake. And it was just focusing on the why is it red? What's the reason for the red? Why is the red so important? What is the year? And focusing on those questions, he was able to give the client what they desired, what they needed, what they lusted for, rather than what they asked for.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story. And again, it highlights how you can apply that why and digging deeper into the desires of the customer to provide that experience. And I agree with you, absolutely. Everything is about delivering an experience today. And a lot of the, you know, I think the risk today with technology and how it's much easier to put a store online and make sales online using technology, people kind of forget about the experience part of it and the human interaction part of it. So you can differentiate yourself by providing a better experience.
Yeah, exactly. And you just got to ask why. You know, I've given you an example now of a toilet roll and of a bakery.
Yeah.
So can you just imagine in whatever business you ask or whatever business you're in, if the person actually looked at you and you said, why is that important? Can you imagine what depth of a response you would get and how powerful and how in control you then become to surpass what they were asking for?
Yep, absolutely. And I've gone through this exercise in terms of starting projects with people and asking them a lot of questions. A lot of them are why questions and digging deeper. And then, of course, there's other questions that follow up on that. And it always amazes me that, you know, the response is nearly always, oh, most other people don't go to this level of asking questions and digging deeper into what we want to do before we actually start working together. And my response is always, well, unless I know more about what you want, I don't know what I can deliver to you that's going to be of value.
100%. If I don't know where the goalposts are, I may be on the same field, but I ain't going to be scoring anytime soon.
Yeah. That's a good analogy. All right. Well, this is fascinating, Steve. I could go on for ages. We haven't even talked much about what the book writing's done for you. I know there's a story in that too.
It's got me on your podcast.
Well, yes, that's one thing. I think it's a good time, though, to move on to the innovation round. Now, we have touched on some of these topics, but it's probably good to cover them off specifically with some short answers. So it is the Buzz, our innovation round designed to help our audience who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field with some tips from your experience. So Five questions, as I said. The first one is, what's the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Get up.
Get up. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. It starts by getting up. Yeah. A lot of people will sit there, procrastinate, plan, structure, formulate. No, get up, make a step. Whatever you're going to do, get up, take one step towards the goal, whatever it is. The death of all business is a business plan. So stop overthinking things and just do the first thing. Yeah. Get up.
Yeah, action is the most important thing. You're
imperative.
Right. Because there's lots of ideas that people have. And one of the things that I always find funny, and I do this from time to time myself, so I'm not pointing the finger at anybody else, is, oh, I thought of that several years ago. You know, somebody had brought out a new product or a neat solution to a problem, and, oh, yeah, I thought of that a few years ago. But, of course, they took action. Yeah.
Yeah, they did. I remember Jay Abraham once said, a brilliant idea is worthless with zero action. A mediocre idea is brilliant with positive action. So, yeah it's everything's about the action, not the idea.
Great. Now, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Constantly try new things. And it could be anything from listening to a different radio station, trying something on the menu that I've never even heard of before. Just I constantly stretch my scope of experience by trying many, many, many things. And they can be low liability by listening to a radio station from a foreign country. But it does expand your perspective and your mind path when you're open to that change. If you can be open to change on the little things, you're open to innovative change on the big things.
Yeah, that's great advice. So being open to change with little things is less threatening. And then, of course, trying out different things to learn and experience and grow.
Yep.
All right. Now, do you have a favorite resource that you use most often?
I would probably say the radio, which sounds weird.
Yeah.
But I constantly have music on. I'm on a podcast with you now. I turned the music off before I got on this podcast. When we hang up, it'll be 2 nanoseconds before I hit the play. I constantly have music playing because it invigorates, generates, vitalizes, gets me moving. And I have such a wide range of music, from Bocelli to Pearl Jam. Anything makes me respond and react. So I would say my greatest resource in the planet would be music.
That's great. I sometimes have music on, but sometimes I need it quiet. So
yeah, my wife's like that. My wife wants it quiet, which is really, really upsetting when I've got my music on. So I have headphones all over the place.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, how do you go on the motorbike when you're riding the motorbike?
Well, the beautiful thing is the motorbike is my meditation because I listen to the sound of the bike. The engine is my music.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, now what's the best way to keep a project on track?
I do a lot of audits. So if I've got a project, the first thing you got to do is know when the project's finished. So if you're going to do something and you're going to go, well, I'm going to be doing this, when are you going to be doing that? Well, I'm going to be doing it in 4 months' time. When in 4 months' time? Tuesday the 17th at 4 p.m. is when it will be done. All right. Then you knock back 4 weeks, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. You start reverse engineering back to the day you are today and start dissecting the project into those chunks.
Yeah, and then regular check-ins. And, of course, that way you
– Yeah, and you audit it. You put it literally – you set an appointment with yourself. Next Friday at 4 p.m., a review – has this been done? 2 weeks after that, has this been done? There is no one more annoying than you because you can't go away. Yeah. So if you keep setting that appointment, guess what? You'll adhere to it. And I have never had a project that I've actually finished on time. They've always been finished ahead of time because I don't want to talk to me.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, love it. Okay, now what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Oh, God, that's so bloody easy. Stop being like everybody else and start being like you.
Yeah.
The dumb thing is we were all born unique and then we spend the next 30 years of our lives trying to fit in.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous. No one that stood out in life did it by following anyone else. So, and people with me, I guarantee you, there are people on this podcast that are probably already turned off. They've gone, I don't like his tone of voice. I don't like his attitude. I don't like his questions. I don't know what he looks like, but I don't like it. And they've switched off. Okay. And then there'll be others that it will be cheering for. And they'll be like, oh, I resonate with this guy. Focus on those that resonate with you. Get clients that you can connect with effortlessly. Because the more effort you put into making a relationship, the less effort you can focus on actually perpetuating it, what it is that you're supposed to be doing for the person. So I'm a great believer that stop trying to be like anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, there's an argument that says, look at successful people and learn from them and you can model from them. But I think there's a real risk that people are actually copycatting rather than taking the learnings and incorporating it into their own style and their own person.
Well, you said it correctly there, you know, learn from them. Don't copy them.
Yeah.
You learn from what did they do that made them stand out? What did they risk to desire achievement? You know, emulate and focus and copy that. But just because you move into the computer industry doesn't mean you have to wear a hoodie or a black polo neck and look like Steve Jobs.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I had an interesting chat yesterday with an accountant on the podcast, and they were quite unique, and he's actually I think he's a motorbike fan, but he's a big guy like you, and he has a beard and he has tattoos, and he doesn't turn up in a suit and tie and briefcase like your stereotypical accountant. And they throw parties, and he loves his whiskey, so they have parties where they do whiskey tastings. So he was a real embodiment of that. You know, I'm Andrew and I just happen to be good at accounting, but first and foremost, it's me.
Yeah, no, that's good. I like that.
Mm. All right. Well, thanks, Steve. This has been really great. Now, where can people find out more about you and perhaps even reach out to say thanks for what you've shared?
Well, I have a Facebook page called An Entrepreneur's Advantage with Steve Sims, and there's only one M in Sims. Or you can go to stevedsims.com, again, one M. Or hit me up at Sims Distillery, again, 1M, simsdistillery.com. That'll give you all of my little teachings there on an easy-to-use platform.
All right. Well, we'll have links to those in the show notes so that people can click straight through. Now, finally, what kind of parting piece of advice would you like to leave the listener with today, particularly for those that, you know, are looking for the secret to being a leader in innovation and in their field?
Put the effort into being you and not trying to copycat somebody else. You really want to focus on you time and time again. That will be what gets you ahead of the game.
Yeah, great advice. All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously today, Steve. I've really had a ball and enjoyed this immensely and learned a lot. And I really appreciate you for sharing those stories with us today, and I wish you all the best for the future, and let's keep in touch.
Appreciate it, mate. Thank you.
Thanks. I hope you enjoyed that delightfully engaging conversation with Steve and took something away from his episode. There's so much wonderful information in what Steve shared that we can apply in any of our businesses. Some standouts for me are, first of all, take action. Nothing is of value until you take action with the ideas. And also accept and embrace failure to learn from it. And, of course, his magic question. I'd love to know what you took away from Steve's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Steve Sims. That is STEVE. SIMS, or lowercase, or one word, innovabiz.co/Steve Sims. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Steve there, as well as links to his website, his social media pages, the Sims Distillery website, and the other resources we spoke about in the conversation today. Steve suggested we have conversations with Zachary Babcock of Underdog Empowerment, with pro-victim rights and personal safety advocate Tim Larkin, with Jeffrey Madoff of Madoff Productions, and with Jeff Spencer, the corner man and champion maker, on future InnovaBuzz podcast episodes. So Zachary, Tim, Jeffrey, and Jeff, keep an eye on your inboxes for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Steve Sims. Remember to check out our Marketing Master mini class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free, my gift to you, and accessible without even giving away your email. But most importantly, in less than 30 minutes, you'll gain absolute clarity about your ideal client and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. And if you'd like our help to go even deeper into marketing mastery, or if you'd like our help in setting up or producing a podcast of your very own, then send me an email to jurgen@innovabiz.co and we'll set up a quick call just to have a conversation and find out if we're a good fit for one another. Tune in again next week to the InnovaBuzz podcast. We've got some more fantastic guests lined up, including Dr. Sandy Everleth. She's an optometrist and also a digital marketing consultant and film producer. And Nadine McGrath of Creative Content Co. Stay connected with us by subscribing to the InnovaBuzz podcast at innovabuzz.com/subscribe. innovabuzz.com/subscribe. Make sure you never miss another episode. It would also mean a lot to me if you leave us a review, because what you think matters. I'd love to hear your thoughts, your ideas, your suggestions, or questions you have, so go ahead and share them in the comments below the blog post for this episode. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.